WBAI New York, WBAI.org online. Now stay tuned for The Positive Mind, coming up.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Positive Mind. I'm Kev O'Donoghue here with Ben Starr, bringing you some ideas, concepts, guests, try and help you lead a happy new year, lead a positively minded life. But I'm so eager to say happy new year to our New York audience, because it is a new year in a lot of ways, right? It is a new year. Doesn't it feel like a new year? Why is New Year's in January? Why isn't it in September, Ben?
Well, we're in a lunar calendar New Year right now. This is a lunar New Year.
Why aren't we following the moon?
I believe the 12-month is that the Gregorian calendar, if I'm not mistaken?
You know stuff like this. That's one of the many reasons you're the co-producer, co-host here on the show, that you know.
And, you know, the Romans added 2 months that weren't there, right? Uh-huh. August and July were added.
Oh.
We're never really there. August for Augustus and July for Julius Caesar.
There you go.
Right?
I love you.
And that's why October, when you think of Oct, should be like the 8th month, is actually the 10th month, because they added the 2, which pushed September,
yes,
the 7th month to 9.
Wow.
October, the 8th month to 10. November, the 9th month.
Wow.
And December, that DEC, D-E-C,
uh-huh,
meaning 10.
Right.
Right? Like a decathlon or...
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well... Thank you for all that information. I'm going to rush to my computer after the show and really, what does November mean?
It means the 9th month, but it's the
11th
month.
Okay, so December means 10. What? Okay.
The Romans added.
I'm just trying to figure out how to stump Ben Starr here, and there's just no way it's going to happen today. But anyway, we want to say Happy New Year also to all our Jewish people who are having their own New Year.
Sure.
Right? But it's also, you know, it's a kid's New Year. Right? Didn't the beginning of the school year feel like the beginning of the year? Like you're at the bottom of a hill. You're going to school. The school year is like going up a hill.
Sure. And as a kid, I mean, this is my personal experience, but as a children, our measurement of time, our concept of time is different, right? Because when we're younger, it's a different context. Hmm. When you tell a 5-year-old, you know, Christmas isn't for another 2 months,
mm-hmm,
that might as well be 2 years to a 5-year-old kid.
Yes.
Because the 5-year-old has lived so much shorter of a lifespan.
Right.
That 2 months, you know, nowadays,
right,
I'm in my 30s, you're a little bit older, 2 months to someone like you or me is a blink of an eye.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I think as children, we thought of time in the context of summers.
Mm.
Right? Summers were kind of the marker. I think, how many summers ago was that? And that was how I thought of years, in terms of the school year versus the summer.
Mm. Yeah, I love it, man. We got to investigate this neurocognitively. What does a span of time mean to each person at a different age of their life? You're right. As you get older, it feels like the years are just rushing by.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, 10-year-old, 2 months can seem like a whole year.
Yeah.
So I'd be interested in finding out the psychological research about that, and we will look into it. But
I spoke to my grandfather about this recently. He's 91.
Right.
So for him, a year, it's nothing. It's like it's no time at all, really.
Mm. Mm.
You know. And then for that child, a year. I mean, think about how dense a year in a child's life can be.
Right.
Right. As adults, we're sort of settled into our routine, to where we are, to our lives.
Yeah.
As a kid, a year, I mean, think of the change that happens in a year for a child.
Yeah, I think that's a real good point, Ben. And it's going to bring us to our topic today, but I did want to say Happy New Year to everybody out there. Because aside from your age or whatever, the change in weather, the sound of September really does feel like a total different year. A total change.
Yeah, it's amazing how it all just shifted right after Labor Day. You know, in France, they call this time of year rentrée, which means re-entry. And it's for everybody, not just for school children.
Mm.
Sort of the reset.
Yes,
back
right.
to work, back to school, back to the rhythm of daily life.
And in France, they vacation for the whole month of August, generally. We get 1 or 2 weeks here in the U.S.
Yeah, everything kind of just shuts down in August.
Yes, it really does. If you've been in Europe, you know that during the summer months, especially August, that the whole city and country shuts down. But you brought up a good thing about children and their experience of time and the memories of childhood, remembering what it was like to be a first grader, starting the new school in general. What was it like? What was it like getting your first book back?
Terrifying.
Can you remember getting it?
I remember.
I remember my first school belt. More than that, I remember the outfit, but I remember the belt.
I remember my first day of kindergarten, 5 years old. Terrifying.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's a psychologist, Alfred Adler, who says, what is your first memory? That's how he begins therapy with a client. What is your first memory? It doesn't have to be the first day of school, you know.
Mine's even earlier than that.
Yeah, some people, most people, I believe he says it starts, can go back to age four. But how you answer that question, like is it a sad story or is it a happy story, can often determine.
Do you want to hear mine?
What? Yeah.
It's neutral. I don't think it's happy or sad.
Okay.
We lived in an apartment building on 14th Street, and there was a couch. And the couch was pushed up against the wall, which had a window. And I was a little toddler. I was short. But I knew that if I climbed up on the couch, I could see out the window.
Uh-oh.
So my first memory is just climbing up on that couch with my hands and knees up against the back of the couch, looking out the window.
Mm.
First thing I remember.
Wow.
Looking south across 14th Street.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's neutral, but it wasn't neutral for your parents. Imagine a parent watching their four-year-old climb up on a couch near a window. What level, what floor of the building
were
you?
It was a high floor. It was 14th floor or something.
You know, so there
it
is.
But the window wasn't open. I mean, in my memory, it wasn't open.
Uh-huh.
I remember just wanting to see outside what was going on. You know.
Yeah. So there it is. But that would, see, I would think, now Ben's a daring guy. What was the word I used to describe you a couple of weeks
bold,
ago?
Bold, I think.
Bold. There it goes. There's my theory. Ben is a bold man and a bold four-year-old to climb up on the couch to look out the window and see this magical world we have. Anyway, we want to tell you we have a guest today. We have Nicole Wilcox back with us today to talk about being a kid again. Hi. Hi, Nicole. Say hello.
Hello. It's nice to be here again.
It's nice to have you back. You know, we had Nicole in a few months ago, maybe 2 months ago, talking about creative arts therapy or even just a month and a half ago.
I think it was July.
And we wanted her to come back to talk about this new year for kids. What is it kids go through being back in school? You know, back in the day when there was any trouble at a school, you dove under the desk. Right, do you remember? Did you dive under a desk, or was that really...
That's more my dad's generation.
Yeah, it was my generation, for sure.
I think the two of us are in the fortunate generation where we escaped the scary
diving
drill.
Diving under the desk.
Yeah,
it was after the diving under the desk and before the active shooter.
You don't know what you miss. There's plenty of gum, there's plenty of gum under there.
Yeah. Some of it's mine.
So, yes, but it was a serious business back in the 50s. Really, right after the war, well, World War II, that the schools were introducing this concept of nuclear holocaust and having children as little as kindergartners dive under the desk. Well, what do you think kids today need to face? What are kids today facing in terms of fear at school? Bullying? Bullying is very big now, right?
Bullying is a huge issue, and this the active shooter phenomenon is very frightening, I think, across the nation.
Do you think kids today are really going to school thinking about active shooters?
I hope not.
Right.
I believe that our children are safe at our schools across the nation for the most part, and I really truly hope that they go into school knowing that they're safe and it's a place to learn. But one of the reasons I'm here today is to talk more about this phenomenon of active shooter drills that have been passed by legislation across most states in the United States now.
Now, you're against them.
I'm against them for all ages.
Good. I want to hear. We really want to educate the public today about this thing because it can really traumatize a kid, a child, for the rest of their life. Right? I mean, people that have lived through Columbine, Parkland, Santa Fe, what are the other names? Sandy Hook.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as shootings, where the shootings have happened.
Right.
Yeah.
These people are really affected for a lifetime.
Absolutely. It changes your entire outlook on the world when you've survived a shooting.
Yeah. So it's hard to think that kids are not aware of it nowadays.
Oh, they're absolutely aware of it, I think. And now that, I mean, one of the messages we'd like to really promote today, I think collectively, is that parents can have a voice in this new process of your children being subject to anti-shooter drills, because it is happening. And I don't know that all parents are even aware that it's happening.
Well, let's just put it out there. New York State passed a law in May of 2017 requiring, it's called New York State Law 6272-A, requiring schools, public, all institutions, public and private, up to high school and through high school, not the universities, to perform 12 evacuation drills per year, 8 of which have to be active shooter drills. Emergency response drills shall include drills to respond to an active shooter or other lethal attacker. Think of that. I mean,
that's
a lot. Is that necessary for a kindergartner?
No.
For a first grader? You see, for a second grader?
No.
I mean, we did some shows on shooting, active shooting. Right, Ben? The school, we did mass shootings, so,
yeah.
Right? We didn't do school shootings particularly. And they're finding the element of bullying to be, you know, one of the top two or three indicators of a school shooting. That are kids in second grade being bullied? Kids in third grade being bullied?
I think bullying can go on at any age. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that parents and teachers need to remain mindful of all the time and be on the lookout for, creating opportunities for kindness and compassion. And, you know, we're talking about rejuvenation and a new beginning, and we're entering a new school. So this is an excellent time to introduce this idea of creating compassion more in the classroom and at home, and giving children opportunities and invitations to be kind to each other, to try and enter the new school year in a preventative note.
Because you've seen the fallout.
I've seen the fallout. I've seen the awful side. And
Nicole Wilcox was one of the first trauma therapists, to appear on site at Sandy Hook Elementary School, to be there for the community, the parents, the school. And tell us a little bit about that experience.
So I was called in by close family friends and went into Newtown, Connecticut for the first time myself only 4 days after the tragedy happened there, in December 2012, and upon my arrival, I was the first person to arrive that was skilled and prepared to help the children, the young children. Hmm. And this was at the Sandy Hook Healing Project. And what I began to see rather quickly was an immense overflow of compassion and strength and gratitude from the community, and an obvious and evident need as a clinician for therapeutic services.
Mm-hmm.
For all ages. I mean, it was evident because we're dealing with the loss of 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds.
Right.
But looking back, it was all ages. Everyone benefits from the service of trauma therapy in that regard. And then the amount of trauma, the devastation an entire community is subject to, is the difference between a massacre versus an isolated shooting incident.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying that these drills, now required by law, are actually re-traumatizing or traumatizing in themselves? I mean, I can imagine it. I mean, Sandy Hook is no longer, right? They demolished the building.
They go to school in a different building
now. They go to a school in a different building now. But if you were a student there and now you're required to do these drills, I mean, I would expect Connecticut, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know exactly.
We need to find out, does Connecticut require it like New York State requires it?
Handling it differently at that particular
school. At that particular school, yeah. So what, okay.
If we think about a child who's never been exposed, they don't live near Newtown, they don't live near Santa Fe, Texas, they don't live near Parkland, and they've never been exposed to an active shooter in any instance in their life, and they have a fairly normal existence. And then suddenly they're announced that, like, say, let's walk through a scenario.
Right.
Suddenly we have a first grader who the teacher is like, okay, we're practicing a, say they call it a safety drill, best case scenario.
Okay.
And they ask all the children to get into the corner of the back closet and we're going to be quiet for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Without a lot of other information, the children don't necessarily know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say. I mean, as a clinician standing by, I've seen instances on both where if there's a perceived threat to a child, if then a child says, hey, why are we doing this? And the teacher's response is, in case a bad person comes into the school and they're not given any other information,
right?
Depending on that child's previous experience, they could become very frightened. What does that mean, a bad person?
Right.
Each child's going to have a different thought process on that.
And the world is already a dangerous place for kids, for little children especially, right? I mean, they need the reassurance of adults to make their environment feel safe.
Absolutely.
And if the adult is feeling anxious or afraid, the child is going to pick that up.
Yeah.
And we don't know really what that child is going to do with that, what particular child is going to do with that. So the question is, like, are these drills necessary? Obviously, there are some states that won't allow it at all. They're not. Every state is different, right? It's not a national, it's not a federal law.
Correct.
New York State has the law, but other states don't have any law about this, you know? I mean,
of which, though, you should still ask, because any school can adopt a drill even if it's not sanctioned. So if it's not the law, a school can still choose.
Would that be up to the principal or the faculty?
Superintendent
of the school.
Yeah.
But you
reminded me of something. Can I jump in real quick?
Sure.
That the approach of the teachers and the administration and the teachers and the parents have everything to do with how a child perceives a drill. So if the adults around are flooding with dialogue about how scary it is when a shooter comes into the building and how horrifying it is, that's going to transfer into the children, and then they're going to perceive that there may have been a real shooter.
Right. Right. And so the teachers are learning some tricks, right? They're learning, like, little ways to diffuse the sense of danger by having the kids sing a song or something, right? Or do a mind game or something. Teachers are distracting the kids, talking about favorite candies or different things as a way to manage the anxiety from the adults or in the building in general. So, but not guaranteed to really have an ameliorative effect for the child. But it's safe to say that if the adult is in a state of high alert, that he's going to create that for children too. So it's what I wanted to get at was the community response at Sandy Hook that you see, because you would prefer what? You would prefer the community be engaged and compassionate and kind, and do what, as opposed to these drills?
You mean in regard, like, you mentioned Sandy Hook, and then you also mentioned community response.
Well, you said that the people at Sandy Hook, the parents, the community, were so kind and compassionate and focused on...
Well, they were in a different state of healing. I mean, they were in shock.
Right.
And they were just hit with such a disaster.
Yeah.
I think it's a different situation.
Yes, I know. But ultimately, you think that educating the community and parents to be involved in this issue, as opposed to responding to a state-imposed law, is the solution, or a solution?
Absolutely, I think so. I mean, I think in the instance of New York State, it looks like the senators approved this legislation without necessarily being educated on the protocols. Doing my own research, it's very difficult to find where the evidence is for this decision. I don't see. There's no reference list when they talk about Run, Hide, Fight, which was the latest protocol released in 2013 by the U.S. Department of Education.
Right.
It's released with a brochure and a poster. It doesn't give a lot of clinical information to say, we're giving you this as a drill based on this rationale.
And you would think at this stage of the game there would be a heck of a lot more communication between families, parents, and the school, and vice versa. The school and the parents. Like, I wonder how many parents in New York State know that this is a law now. that their that their first grader, their second grader is going to be exposed to an active shooting drill at school four times this year.
I would be very surprised.
And what does that drill include? You know, parents still don't know. I mean, with email and everything available to get information out there, what your child is being exposed to every day, what kind of school your child's going to,
right?
That this parents' community still don't know what's going on in that red brick house, you know?
So, and that this is a question you need to ask this year. Going in, you should walk right in, go right into the principal's office and say, when are you offering active shooter drills? And do you do teacher only or do you include the pupils? Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You were going to bring in a friend to give us a call. She is on the line. Do you want to introduce her before she calls in?
Absolutely. This is Jen Towson. She's a music therapist and clinical director calling us from Houston Methodist in Houston, Texas.
Hi, Jen. Welcome to WBAI.
Hello.
Hi, Jen.
Hello there. So we have a lot to ask you. I don't know how much time you have. We're talking about, I don't know if you've heard what we've been talking about, but we've been talking about parents not knowing actually about this as a law. Is it a law down in Texas, these active shooting drills?
It is not a law. There's some work happening in legislation at the time currently to look at what Texas will do. But, you know, we're on an odd cycle for our legislation. We only meet every other year. We have a pretty short session, so we don't go into session until January. So we'll see what happens this upcoming session with legislation around shooter drills.
And what's your point of view about it? I mean, do you have are you organizing people to protest it or advocate for it, the type of drills that these should be? What's your take on it?
My take on it is a pretty personal one. My son experienced an active shooter drill at a daycare, actually, not a school, a daycare program where I did not know that it was happening, and he started exhibiting high signs of anxiety, and upon further exploration with him about where this anxiety was coming from, he outright said, well, someone might shoot me.
How old was he?
He was 3 years old at the time.
Oh, my gosh.
It's terrible.
But very young to have these kinds of thoughts, and I thought, well, what is this coming from? It was a couple of months after the Parkland shooting, but that was in Florida. We live in Texas. We don't watch the news in our home. You know, had protected them from that information, so mm-hmm. I didn't know where he learned this, and I went to the school, and the teachers had concerns because he was crying a lot at school, which is very unlike him. He was very clingy. So I spoke with them, and they told me, well, you know, we did have an active shooter. And I said, well, when was this? And what was the process? I didn't know about it. Apparently there was a note that was sent home, but we weren't at school the day that the note was sent home. And so we missed the message.
No.
And the, you know, by all counts, I think this school did a pretty good job with their protocol. They had a password that didn't have anything. It was Jesus Loves Me. It's a Christian school. It was Jesus Loves Me. And the teachers took the kids into the closet and they played with flashlights. So by all counts, like that's a pretty good way to do it. If you're going to do something like that, that's probably a pretty good way to do it.
Okay, so you had no complaints with how they handled it, but you did have complaints about you not being notified.
I had complaints about not being notified, and then I learned that several of the parents were talking about it in the hallway when they were picking up their kids, because it's a daycare. It's not protected space in those hallways, and so this is how he learned about it. But just the idea that learning about that a shooter could come into this school caused so much anxiety and grief for him that, mm-hmm. I mean, he's been in therapy since. I'm happy to report that he's doing better now, but, you know, he has had some strong responses. I can tell you, as a three-year-old, he's gone into play therapy and set up all of the figurines and taken one figurine and shot them all and looked at his therapist and said, why did he do that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the important thing to remember here is that kids can understand. I think that was my big thing, is that it was considered that, well, they're so young, they wouldn't understand what we're saying anyway.
Right. Right.
You know, and so I think one of my take-home messages is hey, even the youngest, even, you know, I heard you all speaking about the anxiety of the teacher being put onto the children, and that the children are going to pick up on that if they're sure. fearful. But they also have a knowledge about them. You know, for me, my son's innocence was shattered. His three-year-old childhood innocence was shattered, and he felt like the whole world was now unsafe.
Of course.
And so I think it's really important to talk about how drills are happening in schools. My daughter started kindergarten this year, and the first thing I asked was, do you have active shooter drills, and what do they look like?
Yeah.
And I was told, yes, they do, and they're not set up well. And so I'm working with the principal to talk with the PTA and the community about how active shooter drills might look different, and what are some things we can do differently about it. I don't think that it's appropriate to tell a kindergartner we're practicing in case a bad guy comes.
Jen, we need you to stay on the line. We're just going to do station identification.
If you're just joining us right now, you're tuned into 99.5 FM, WBAI. We're speaking with Jen Townsend from Texas, discussing this phenomenon of these active shooter drills that have become legislated in many places, it seems. Mm. And their effect on children, and it can be a very deeply traumatizing effect.
Public and private educational institutions. So so you said to your new daughter, your daughter's kindergarten teacher, what are the protocols? What are you doing active shooting drills? They did say yes, but they didn't have specifics on how they're going to do them.
So they've had the drills already in the previous year. They had drills. And so, you know, she told me that they bring them all to the closet in each classroom. In the kindergarten, at least, has a bathroom. So they bring them all into the bathroom that's there in the classroom, and they tell them to sit quietly for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what she told me was they tell them that we're practicing in case a bad guy comes in. And right. I think that just the precedence for them to not feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a good learning environment. And as kindergartners, especially, you know, these younger ages, my personal thought is that maybe active shooter drills do look different through the ages, right?
Right, definitely different in high school than in daycare or in elementary school. You would hope, yeah. Just tell us a little bit about the symptoms your son was showing. So just educate people on, let's say they do a drill in one of our schools here in New York within the next few weeks. And six of the drills have to be done before December 30th of this year. So can you tell us, you say he was anxious, mm-hmm. he was clingy. What else was he exhibiting?
He was fearful to go outside, afraid of... it's important to note that it's not all related to just shooting and the fear of shooting. So he became fearful of bugs.
Yeah.
He wouldn't go, his aunts might eat him. He obsessively talked about death.
He talked about death?
Yeah, he would ask, am I going to die today? What if I die before we get to do such and such, whatever it might be?
Mm-hmm.
He had regression in sleep and potty training, so he was fully potty trained, and he was fully sleeping through the night. He regressed in both of those areas and started having accidents in the night, waking up multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
Even as recently as a month and a half ago, he had a little spurt where he started waking up again at 4:30 and saying at night he was afraid to go to sleep, that he might not wake up. So just this understanding that death is real and death could happen to him.
Yeah.
At an age that is not typical to have that kind of realization was overwhelming. How does his brain make sense of that when it's not yet developed to do so? Mm. And so all of the anxious, you know, very clingy, had to be touching me. Mm-hmm. If I was home, I wasn't home, my mother-in-law, he had to be touching her, or my husband, he had to be touching. Being in the same room was not enough. Like, he had to be constant meltdowns, yeah. Lots of crying. Just his emotional cup was full and it was full from anxiety emotions. So there was no room for the other emotions.
Okay, and now it's a year later or 2 years later?
No.
This happened in April. So
Oh, wow. Okay.
7 months.
7 months, and he's just starting to recover. Right. You know, just as an outsider, what astonishes me is that the school would do it without notifying the parents electronically to let every – and that the schools maybe don't have this conversation or contact with parents electronically. I mean, everything is done electronically now or texted, that the school would text all parents and have those numbers on. I mean, I know teachers now have parents' phone numbers in their phone so that when one of the kids in their classroom is acting up, they will talk – they will call the parent up in the middle of the classroom.
Wow.
You know, to stop this child from misbehaving and acting out. I mean, this is the effect that the technology can have for teachers and administrations and schools. And yet, for things like this that can really be traumatizing for this young boy for 7 months and maybe longer, that the school, the administration, the buildings, the institutions are not talking to the people they're serving. So this is one of the things that astonishes me. And even this New York State law, where I would bet 1 out of 10 parents knows this, that there are active shooter drills this year. It was news to me a month ago. I didn't even know about it.
It was news to me coming. I mean, Jen, after you shared your story with me when I was in Texas, that's when I started to do research about New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we thank you for calling us, Jen. Are you close to Santa Fe?
My house is about 20 minutes from Santa Fe High School.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she's right
and
there.
And what are they doing? Do you know anything about what they're doing at the school?
So at the school particularly, I know that they have additional safeguards in place. We've got a legislator in our district that is been charged with defining and developing a plan for school safety, and he's someone that I'm hoping to get a meeting with soon as well to discuss experience and to discuss some of these things that maybe he'll take into consideration. I don't know the exact drills that they have in place at Santa Fe High School. My mother was a substitute teacher, and I know that she had to go through some pretty specific trainings leading up to this school year around active shooters. So they are doing some of that work. Nicole and I have been working together focused on how we can provide some creative arts therapy services to families in the community there in Santa Fe. But so my focus has been more community-based than in the actual school.
Fantastic. Okay, well, we're going to talk about creative arts therapy, Jen, Nicole, here in the studio. But, Jen, we wanted to thank you for making the call and being part of this for our audience today.
My pleasure. I want to thank you all for taking the time to talk about something so important. I think you're part of the effort, so thank you.
Thank you. I can guarantee by this time next year we'll have, you know, the BAI audience will fully know the laws and what they can do to contact local schools in their community to be fully informed and really have a voice in this issue. So thanks for the call.
Great to hear you, Jen.
You too. Bye-bye.
Yeah, so we do want to talk about the healing, though. I mean, you had vast experience at Sandy Hook, and now Santa Fe. Have you been? You've been down to Santa Fe?
I have.
Tell us about a little bit before the musical break.
So my visit to Santa Fe was really moving. I mean, it was a good reminder of how powerful and strong a community can be when they come together after an awful tragedy. And it was the students who contacted me. I want to share that. I think it's really significant. I made a local contact in New York City who was an alumna of Santa Fe High School. And it was high school students that survived who really contacted me to come into Santa Fe and begin to mobilize local art therapists and music therapists to help them.
We're going to take a quick musical break. We'll be back after this. Thank you.
Well, the sun's not so hot in the sky today. And you know I can see summertime slipping on away, slipping on on. A few more geese gone, a few more leaves turning red. But the grass is as soft as a feather in a feather bed. Oh, darling. So I'll be king and you be queen. Our kingdom's gonna be this little patch of green. Won't you lie down with me right now in this September grass? Down now, September breath. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, the memory is like the sweetest pain. Yeah, I kissed a girl at a football game. Still smell the sweat and the grass stain. We walked home together, but I was never the same. Yeah. But that was a long time ago. So where is she now? Why, no, no. September grass. Won't you lie down now? September grass. Oh, September grass is the sweetest kind. It goes down easy like apple wine. Hope you don't mind if I pour you some. Be that much sweeter by the winter to come. Do you see those ants dancing on a blade of grass? Do you know what I know? That's you and me, baby. Yes, it is. So small and the world so vast, we found each other down in the grass. Won't you lie down with me right here, September grass? Won't you lie down now in this September grass?
Taylor here on The Positive Mind, 99.5 FM WBAI. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue and Nicole. I'm so sorry, Nicole. I just blanked on your last name.
It's okay. It's Wilcox.
Nicole Wilcox.
Yeah.
I hate it when that happens.
Right.
So maybe I'll change it.
Okay. September grass, you know, it's a reminder that it's a new season out there almost officially. Can you tell us anything about September, Ben? Any history, meaning behind September, the moons that we can expect?
Well, I mean, that wasn't what I would have picked. I would have picked Earth, Wind, and Fire. But, hey.
But the grass is changing, and it's getting a little stiffer and firmer out there. We're just encouraging people to lie down in it. Right? Following up our show on sensuality and the senses last 2 weeks ago now. But anyway, we're back to this serious topic because we want to get into the meat of this, Nicole. I really would like you to take people into the treatment of a child that is like Jen's son. What you do with such a child. These are like red flags to parents. When a child is clinging, grabbing you more than they usually do, when they're waking up in the middle of the night, when they're, you know, hanging on to you, when they're unable to even speak. What are the signs that little children, young children, let's say before the age of 6 or 7, exhibit? Because, again, I'm going to remind people, we have the expert here who was at the Sandy Hook Elementary School after the shooting that, you know, 22 children? It was 22 children.
Total in Newtown?
Yeah, in Newtown.
No, there were some children and some teachers. Administrators were also killed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us the symptoms that are exhibited of a child in trauma.
So upset, they can have reoccurring events of an upsetting actual event that took place where they're replaying it in their play. They can be waking up with nightmares. Jen mentioned some of them, of like bedwetting and regression, where like a 5-year-old child could start to do things that they used to do when they were 3 years old.
So a bedwetting would be an obvious signal to the parents that the child is in distress.
Absolutely.
And they don't have the words to say what exactly it is. So the body is acting out the trauma for them.
Right. It's typical in our field to say the body holds the trauma. The body holds the memory. Where you can, I mean, it's a very physical, usually when someone is experiencing trauma symptoms and the distress, where the scratching of the body, a lot of touching, physical, that's why tags might start to bother a child, or they won't want to wear their underpants anymore, or insects around them will bother them more, or the things in their food, they might get really picky about how they're eating. Those are the types of behaviors. And it's also important to be mindful that it could be an isolated incident. Like they might be going through a tough transition because one of their parents is traveling for work where it only lasts a few days. There's a difference between.
Okay. So classic separation anxiety,
right.
or incident
or is there
or
something distressing,
trauma.
Right.
Yeah.
That you should ask more questions.
Right.
Like our caller did.
Yeah. So in Newtown, children were exhibiting some of these symptoms. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell us about somebody, one child in particular.
Well, I mean, I can give one example from the beginning phase. I mean, basically when I went into Newtown, initially the first 2 weeks I was at something called the Sandy Hook Healing Project, where it was an open door, and people came in without appointments all day, every day, 7 days a week. And then after that, I started to volunteer my services because there were many families that said, hey, that was really benefit, and we'd like to keep the art therapy going for our children.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to offer art therapy out of a family friend's home, where they had a really great setup where I was able to use the office space, and then they had a study right next door with a pocket door that looked like a bookshelf where I could be in one space with the children and a parent or parents could be in the other space where they were in
witnessing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, where the child had a sense of privacy and security knowing their parents were right there if they wanted them.
Okay.
But in the moment, they could go into the moment with me, the therapist, because their parents were on the other side of the wall.
Beautiful.
Because oftentimes what we'll see is children carry the fear of not wanting to upset their parents.
Yeah.
Even as young as 3 or 4 or 5.
Of course.
So they'll often reveal things to a trusted therapist or teacher that they wouldn't necessarily reveal to their parent because they don't want to upset the parent.
Mm-hmm. And they're not necessarily doing this through words.
No.
Right?
I mean, some children. Normal development.
Yeah. Yep. Some children might be able to say things that are going on with them and not want to tell their parents, to actually use words. But traumatized children, this outlet of play therapy, of creative arts therapy, is more successful, more beneficial, produces more because?
Well, we've talked about the difficulty of verbalizing once your system has been upset by a really distressing event, or a perceived event. And the reason I'm painting this picture of what the space looked like is because that's another important layer of encouraging a sense of security and safety for young children. But then in this space where I was working with this particular child, he was 6 years old, and he went to a neighboring elementary school that was also locked down, though there wasn't an active shooter on the premises.
Mm-hmm.
But that day, December 14th, all the neighboring schools were also on lockdown for the extended period of time until everything was under control.
Of course, yeah.
And this particular child also lost several friends that he played soccer with, went to church with.
So even though he didn't go to the school,
yeah,
he was affected.
Very affected. And was displaying symptoms like we're talking about. Like, no longer was sleeping through the night. Was having regression with using the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Was very clingy. Wanted to be with the parents all the time. Didn't want to go to school anymore. Wanted to wear his pajamas if they were able to convince him to go to school. So let me take you into the art therapy session.
Yeah.
Where, you know, a sense of safety has been established. The child had been working with me for several weeks. And we were working with a clay process where I use kiln clay because it's very healthy, tactile for kinesthetic movement with the children and their hands. So the child was given the task to create a safe place. And he started to create a swimming pool out of the clay. And there were four figures representing the members of his family swimming in the swimming pool. And then he created this giant mountain with a huge mass on top of the mountain that was larger than the swimming pool. And I'm with him, mirroring the process, very little dialogue going on.
Hmm.
And then when I ask him to describe to me what's happening in this artwork, he starts to share how the family's swimming in the swimming pool, and he says, and that's a giant gun up on the mountain. He said, but the family's okay because the bullets are shooting over the swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
He said, okay, so the bullets are shooting over the swimming pool, and... Go ahead.
I just want to say, because the way you reported this to me, you would say back exactly the words the child is saying. So we want the audience to understand this. You are not interpreting the child's words. You're exactly mirroring back exactly what the child is saying. So take us through those steps.
It's true. So with the trauma therapy process, it's very important to mirror what the client is sharing so that they get a strong sense of their own story. Because that needs to be established in order for a neurobiological shift to actually happen.
Right.
So the child says to me, oh, the gun is shooting the bullets over the swimming pool. I repeat back, oh, the gun is shooting bullets over the swimming pool. And then at the appropriate time, I interject the question of, what if the gun could shoot anything other than bullets? And the child just looks at me. And that's when I give him a little information and I say, it's okay if you don't know right now.
Mm.
We can just think about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the two of us re-enter the nonverbal process and we start working with the clay. And we're role-playing. We're playing. We're entering this
right.
realm.
Right, using materials.
And we're interacting and about 10 minutes goes by. And then the child looks at me and he says, what if all the guns in the world only shot rainbows? And I said, what if all the guns in the world only shot rainbows?
Mm.
He responded with, it would tickle. And I said, it would tickle. And then he truly, in the moment, rolled over giggling, pretending to be tickled. I rolled over giggling, pretending to be tickled. And then we could hear the father with a lighthearted giggle through the wall.
Yeah.
And that is the moment.
Knowing that his child's getting better.
Yeah.
Right.
It's incredible.
Yeah. All that tension that the child is holding in and the representation of the gun. And then all of a sudden he's able to roll over in laughter.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that aha moment.
Mm.
And that in this example, I'm taking that family, that child, into a new place in his memory when he thinks about the tragedy.
Well, say that again. What do you mean?
So that his physical response, like typically if something, we always say triggers the
mm-hmm.
tragedy, triggers the event. Like
mm-hmm.
if a siren goes by and someone, their body goes back to that initial
yes.
threat.
Right.
Now his little body will go back to the higher tier up. He's going to go back to the art therapy session.
Oh.
Where he's going to start, he's going to feel that tickle.
Oh, wow. Why is that? That's a wonderful thing because it actually is a felt shift, you know?
Absolutely.
Right? It's a body shift. And this is what you want in order to mobilize your trauma. from your body is to make a shift and get a shift to happen.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of the nonverbal, why art therapy and play therapy and music therapy can be so incredible with trauma in particular, because you enter through the nonverbal. Where and that's where the trauma exists in the core brain, in our reptile brain, so to speak, that initial brain that's created before language.
Right. I can't underestimate, I can't overemphasize the importance of the mirroring back piece. Right, because you were saying that if you put it in your own words, you're doing the work for the child. Say something about that, right? I mean,
you
want the child to do the therapy.
Absolutely, and it has to be at the pace of the person. You know, each, that's where these instances, if a child is perceived that they're under threat, perceived that they could get injured, that's another layer of trauma where it might not take them as long to get to that space. I gave an example of a child that was in a school very close by and actually lost friends.
Yeah.
And then if we look at a family where they lost a loved one, they lost a child or a parent, they might not ever get to that shift in the beginning. It might take a much longer time before they're comfortable enough with that therapeutic relationship to feel that shift. Because that's the other part, is that clinical lens is huge. Knowing to hold the client space, hold the child space at the pace they need it,
right,
is what helps them the most. Like if I had asked that question before he created the clay sculpture,
right,
he would have never had the insight because he didn't think of it. Yeah. He didn't create the concern.
Right. Yeah, so I just think that that's such a critical piece. And I love the tone of how your voice changed. Oh, so the bullets are shooting, or whatever you said, rainbows.
Yeah.
You know, that your voice, you said the same words, but you said it in a different way. And so I think...
Feels lighter, right?
it really does feel lighter. But you're kind of, I think, subconsciously creating the condition with that for the child to make the shift. I think there's something about the tone of voice of the therapist that can be very important.
Absolutely, the neutrality. But there's also, you bring up the mirroring, where if they're upset, it's important to mirror that upset. Like, be neutral, but also let them see when they're angry, when they're sad, when they're happy.
Yeah, and show it to them maybe in a more dramatic way so that they can own the feeling. Because, I mean, sadness, a child has a hard time.
Well, I'm thinking, you remind me of another example with children from Newtown, a group of siblings where they were really angry and upset and just they only wanted to, like, throw the materials. So I throw the materials. I, too, begin to throw the materials, to which every child is like, oh! They're horrified that there's an adult in the room throwing materials.
Right.
It stops all of them in their tracks. And typically they start to giggle.
And then it's like a freedom. Like, well, we're invited to break the rules.
No, I think they're like, oh, my God, is that what I look like? A lot of them, to me, seem to have this, oh, my goodness, is that really what I look like? And that's the conversation we typically have afterward, if they're verbal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's children that are nonverbal.
So you're saying it inhibits them? They don't want to continue throwing stuff against the wall because you...
I mean, again, I don't recommend them. This. This is in a clinical setting.
Hey, look, we're aiming for healing here. You know, if we need to repaint the walls, it's worth it, right?
No, but in a clinical setting, when they've been guided that I am there to help them overcome their emotional upset, and they're aware of that, and it's within a confined timeline.
Right.
Yeah, if I throw down the pens, just like they're throwing down the pens, they usually stop and go, oh... I'm angry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I go, oh, I'm angry.
Oh, okay. So you're showing them the emotion. And
literally,
and then they can
move by move.
And it helps them own the emotion
through
that, rather than feel prohibited from doing it further.
Exactly. Well, and that's when if I say anything, it'll be, this is a safe place to feel angry.
I wonder, you know, we should have our audience call us with people who have experience with creative arts therapy. Do you have a child that has been exposed to creative? Do you have a child in kindergarten right now? I mean, kindergarten itself is trauma therapy. I mean, I remember kindergarten, right, full of colors all day long and materials and play and inviting the child out, out of themselves into this world. So where, you know, do you have a child in kindergarten? How aware of you are you of when they're anxious, what they're anxious about? Or is your child regressing? Is your child suddenly showing some kinds of symptoms? Give us a call, 212-757-5555.
We're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be back after this with some of your calls. 212-757-5555 is the number to call. You're tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. Foster, Mystic Brew, here on WBAI 99.5 FM. You are tuned into The Positive Mind. I don't know about you, but when I hear that song, I get a big smile on my face. Takes me back. And yes, if you are just joining us, It is the Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue, Nicole Wilcox. We're taking your calls at 212-757-5555. And we will be taking your calls. Yeah. 212-757-5555.
Now, you weren't born when I was born. You were 20 years more than that later. That was a soundtrack from a 70s movie somehow, somewhere.
So that is the...
Go ahead.
What I hear is that is the sample from Electric Relaxation, Tribe Called Quest, which was a staple of my childhood.
In the 90s.
My formative years,
okay.
If you will.
In the 90s.
212-757-5555. That's the number to call. We're taking your calls. We have Donna on the line. Hello, Donna. Thanks for calling.
Hi there.
Hello.
Donna on the line. Hi, Nicole. Hi, Kevin.
Hey.
How are you?
Good. We're glad you're here. So what's your experience?
Thanks for letting me speak. Well, I work as a behavior analyst with children who are on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
And also some young adults. But what I have noticed is that when I shift the session from just doing reinforcements like classical and operant conditioning and reinforcements and add a art component to the therapy session, mm-hmm. the children actually change. They actually, especially the nonverbal ones, you'll get smiles on their faces. If there are kids who are acting out with non-pro-social behaviors, their behaviors over time begin to loosen up, and you actually get giggles. Mm. And then you wonder, what are you laughing at? Oh, rubber ducky, they'll say, or something silly, you know?
So what is...
It releases the stress.
Yeah, yeah. So I can't imagine children on the spectrum have to be exposed to these active shooter drills, right? I mean, are you working in the schools?
Actually, you know what? I just wrote an article about special needs children, special needs students, and school violence. It's in a scholarly review journal.
Okay.
So I do research regarding school violence and special needs children.
Okay.
So that's interesting that you should ask that question.
Well, I can't help but, you know, get an image of autistic children being required to exit a building or being advised that there's a bad person in the building and to act in certain ways, often depending on the severity of the autism. A lot of the times it's a one-on-one experience, right? An autistic child can often... So what kind of madness are we talking about if an active shooter drill is required in that environment?
Well, I'll give you what I have... Let's see, without going off of HIPAA.
Okay, that's important.
It depends on the situation, but I have seen in, for example, some school settings, when the children have an active shooter drill, there is a lot of tension. Some children will hide. Some people will start acting out. And some kids actually do things like pull the fire alarm.
Of course.
Right. Oh, yeah. Response.
Right, because subconsciously,
they're not sure how to respond.
That's going to let them know there's somebody coming to save them, that there's safety. That makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense.
But here's the other thing I'd like to share with you, that even after that active shooter drill is over, when they have bathroom breaks, some kids actually return to pull the fire drill again. Just because, I don't know why they do that, but they'll repeat the act.
Right.
And there won't be a fire drill that day. And sometimes they'll be the elopers, you know, from a classroom or from the bathroom, and they'll run down the hall and they'll pull the fire alarm.
See, now that sounds like reoccurrent behavior of an upsetting event. That's a symptom of being distressed by the actual drill.
Wow, I've never thought of that. That's exactly correct.
That's what it seems like.
Say it again.
I said it seems like they're reoccurring the event, they're role-playing it, because it's a response to a distressful event of the drill.
Right, right.
Now, sadly, the kid will get suspended because they'll say, well, this kid is doing something off task.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it's really probably in response to anxiety because of the drill.
I mean, that child needs counseling right away. I mean, right? Rather than be suspended, we need to find out what the trigger was for the child to do that. And oftentimes they can't even put it into words as to why they did something like that. But it's clearly crazy behavior.
It's a physical response. They're in flight or fight mode.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that's where just the setting, when these drills are going on in what is typically their safe environment, where they're used to, you know, being encouraged to feel safe and secure, and we're reinforcing their positive behaviors all the time, and then an active shooter drill is sprung on them, then when they return to that environment, they're on hyper-arousal mode of like, oh, that might happen.
Right.
Wow.
Especially if, you know, they're already have other disabilities, that you're dealing with a completely different process for them, where I wonder if there's a way to get involved for you at the administrative level to contact the superintendent or principal and say, is there another positive approach we can implement for that classroom?
I definitely can, and not only from an administrative standpoint, but maybe I can go to Trenton, you know?
God, go for it. That's great.
Do some
go to the state legislature.
Yeah,
Donna, can you send me an email with the link to that article that you wrote?
Sure, I will. It's I can tell you the name of the journal. It's the Journal of Educational Leadership and Policy.
Mm-hmm.
It's the special inaugural edition. It's actually in publication right now. The leader. The preface is written by Dr. Evans, who's CEO of the American Psychological Association.
Mm-hmm.
And there are Dr. Norris Haynes is in there from Yale and Southern Connecticut State.
Do you have it as a PDF?
I do.
Can you send it to kevin@thepositivemind.com?
Sure.
kevin@thepositivemind.com.
All right, 1 minute. Just type it in cell phone.
Yeah, really, thanks. We might and leave your phone number. We might want to follow up with you and explore some of the things you're doing.
Thank you. I would really like to just make things better for these children. I think it's just too much.
We know you do.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot.
Thank you so much, Donna. We'll be in touch.
Thank you, too. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
You, too.
Thank you, Nicole. Bye.
Bye.
212-757-5555. It creates a giggle. Right. Creative arts there. We did it here in the studio about a month ago or 6 weeks ago, and we were giggling. We ripped it up and threw it in the air, and I walked out of here feeling like,
are we going to do it
again? I needed that. Well, do you have something for us? Do you have any bubble gum? Do you have any gum for us to? 212-757-5555. We're wondering if your child is exhibiting any symptoms of anxiety, or that they're facing something that they're afraid of. This is back to school, and this is a hard month for children. It's an exciting month, but it's also a difficult month. And if they've suffered exposure to something, they might be showing some signs. We want to hear about it. We want to also advocate for creative arts therapy. This is beyond words. This is using materials that are set up, colors that can get a child to make that bodily shift where they're holding all that tension. And adults. Nicole, talk about the success of creative arts therapy with the adults, the parents.
The adults. Some of my best clients are grown men.
Explain that.
It's true.
Really? We hate to admit that.
Well, trauma hits all types, all ages.
So go ahead.
Right, and especially gun violence in America. I mean, unfortunately, you know, I went into this loving art and psychology.
Right.
And because of the culture we live in now, I've become a specialist with gun trauma, so to speak. But other people have contacted me in the New York City area that have just survived isolated incidences of gun violence.
Okay.
And adults typically that contact me are people that lose their sense of self after a traumatic event has happened and they've survived a gun shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And they realize, you know, a lot of grown men who would never touch art supplies.
Right.
But they know that they're not themselves anymore, and they know they're not sleeping. You know, they know mm-hmm. they're really distressed. And usually it presents itself in a metaphor. I think for a lot of people, so many of us are very visual
mm-hmm.
that people will start to be tormented in their nightmares, in their dreams,
right.
where it's not necessarily the actual event you lived through.
Mm-hmm.
But that's often a real clear indicator for a lot of people. Because you lose your sleep, it sets everything off.
Right. And so the dream becomes a metaphor for the actual event or the anguish that you're going through. And so a long time ago, Sigmund Freud
yeah.
interpreted dreams because the person couldn't say what their repression was directly. They created a scenario in their dreams that would encapsulate the struggle and conflict they were fighting and dealing with.
Absolutely.
So what does a grown man do with creative arts therapy? Do they use crayons? Do they use music? Do they use clay? Do they use
combination?
Paper?
It depends on the person. You know, I often like to use materials that suit the person. You know, one person might want to work with wood blocks
mm-hmm.
And wood glue.
I would love to work
sculptures.
With clay. I mean, that
yeah,
to
clay
me
is my favorite.
Sounds such
I love working with clay.
Yeah. So can you share one breakthrough? One man's breakthrough, one man's successful creative arts therapy session where he shifted, like you say. I mean, we try to create these shifts and help clients create these shifts through something we call focusing, Eugene Genlin's technique of focusing, paying attention to the middle of your body, paying attention to your belly,
right.
and what needs to shift there. Where's the tension?
Number to call is 212-757-5555. We have Peter on the line. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling in.
Hello. I'm calling. This is before you talked about art therapy. You talked about what's your first childhood memory. And I had this insight that my first memories from school, it was a pre-kindergarten, really indicate where my personality is. I mean, my first
It's in New Jersey, Peter.
Huh?
Your personality is in New Jersey.
Well, at the time, I was at the Ebbets Field apartment
kidding.
In Brooklyn.
Peter, I know I can joke with you.
So, okay. So I remember there was a bucket with soapy water in it, and I had an egg beater, and I was doing it, and you make it, and it makes suds. And someone said, Peter, Peter, egg beater. And I remember that. And not only that, one of the teachers said, we need an indoor-outdoor. Now, I realize that probably means a door that one goes in and one goes out instead of both ways. And what I realized, those are my two earliest memories, that they both relate to words, making a connection to words. One is like egg beater, my name. The other is indoor-outdoor. They're opposites. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I realize, you know, a lot of my sense of humor is based. I mean, even today, like someone asked me, this is Trump hadn't been inaugurated yet. Someone asked, they were asking a question from Jeopardy: who's the 32nd president?
Okay.
And I said, let's hope it's Trump. He takes the oath of office, and half a minute later, he resigns. Instead of 32nd president is FDR.
Oh, there you,
you know?
Are. 30 seconds. You know, 30 seconds.
Right, right.
President.
And my mind has a way of twisting words. The 32nd president, half a minute later, you're out of here.
Right.
You know, but I just noticed my sense of humor and my word play and how it relates to my first memories of
I love it.
Noting. You know,
I love it, Peter. Yeah, indoor, outdoor. You have a door.
Right.
You have a door that swings in and swings out. There's some mystery about doorways too, right? I mean, you're changing your location, and so your frame of mind when you move through a doorway. So,
right, right. And
know,
I guess it was. I guess the problem was kids getting hit if you use the same door going in different directions.
Uh-huh.
So we should have one designated for in and one for out. But it just stuck in my head. I guess it was like, you know, my little 3-year-old brain saying, what does that mean? How can you have an indoor-outdoor, you know? And, like, puzzling over the incongruity of words.
Your mind was already complicated at 4 years old.
I was setting myself up for stand-up comedy, I guess.
And that's what you ended up doing?
Well, I mean, obviously it relates to, like, what I said about I did it when I did stand-up comedy, and I related to Donald Trump. Let's hope he's the 32nd president.
Oh, okay.
Or whatever. Related to something. But you know, people like George Carlin, I mean, they made a whole, a lot of his routine was wordplay,
right.
You know?
Absolutely.
He said, when I was a kid, I kept to myself a lot. I had imaginary friends.
Beautiful.
But I didn't bother with them.
Did you have any trauma as a child?
No trauma.
Wonderful. Peter, thanks for giving us a call. Always a pleasure.
Sure thing.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
212-757-5555. We want somebody's experience with creative arts therapy. We're playing here in the studio. Nicole, what do you think Ben's up to over there?
Looks like he's playing
something
with
the sunshine or something. That's sunshine colors. That's, how many kids pick out bright colors in creative arts therapy? Like yellow and orange and red. Like I remember that being like the ones that I always went to as a child.
They're hot, Kevin. You run hot.
I am. I run high.
I mean, Ben's really the one who is choosing the hot colors at the moment. Oh.
Yes, I know. So is there anything about color in creative arts therapy? Obviously, if you're using black, the child is communicating something.
There are lots of indicators, but I think the most important thing is to always go to the person and say, what is the meaning of this color for you? Mostly because you just don't know anyone's family preferences or cultural background.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
There's lots of norms that I pay attention for.
We're going to take another quick call. We have Kamasina on the line. Hello?
Hi, yes, Thomasina calling.
Thomasina, hi. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I have many hats. I want to say a couple of things with different hats on. My first hat to put on is as a teacher. As a teacher, I think that the teachers are not being asked what we should be doing for active shooter drills or for any kind of drills. I'm a high school teacher,
mm-hmm.
and I think that these drills are absolutely ridiculous. They're not going to stop any lives from being lost.
Do other teachers think so too?
Yes, we all feel like, well, not all, but many teachers feel like we're not being asked what we think
the resolve
to these problems are.
So what would be the
answer? I have a lot of suggestions.
Go ahead.
Right.
Give them. Do it right now on the air.
First of all, this might sound crazy, but my coworker and I brought in a fire ladder. And we told the students, if there's an active shooter, we're leaving the room. And you can come with us or not. It's up to you.
Wow.
Come
on. You can't get away with that in a school. You can't
have a ladder. Oh, the boss doesn't know. The boss doesn't know. We hid the ladder in the room.
Okay. So teachers are taking it in their own hands. Their own.
Well, we have to.
Evacuation is a very effective response.
Okay. All
the
right.
The majority and if of you these do shootings, and if there's you only do one. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Right. And my point is all of these schools have cameras, okay? When are we going to start using the cameras?
Are they not, not being used? Yeah.
No, they're in a room where nobody's sitting. So, like, what good is that?
Okay.
So, like, these cameras are all over. We could know where the active shooter is. There is no reason to keep students in a building and the active shooter is in one wing. Just shut the other wing down. I mean, like, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, we have schools that have drop-down doors, okay? We can drop down the doors immediately. If we know where the shooter is, we cut the shooter off, and we could actually trap the shooter in a hallway.
One thing
I want you to get in all your points.
So my other thing is, I know that sounds crazy, but that's something I recently did this year. I also instructed my daughter, who's a high school student. I told her, I go, listen, if you know you're not anywhere near the shooter, you jump out the window and get the hell out of there.
Of course.
Because I think staying in a room is just being, fodder.
How about the communication between teachers and students or administration and families and parents? Like,
Now I'm going to put on my parent hat. So I had a similar situation to the first caller that called. My daughter comes home from school and starts telling me about how she had an active shooter drill and she's very afraid. Is somebody going to come shoot her? Luckily, she did not have trauma, but she did come home and speak to me about it.
Good.
And I don't know if she had slight trauma. I was able to handle it. And you're going to laugh when I tell
you. Real quick, how old is your daughter?
Okay, at that time she was just in elementary school. I think it was like fourth grade when that happened. Now she's a sophomore in high school.
Okay.
So when she was in elementary school, I sat her down and I said to her, I go, think about the situation when we come out of the school. You know all those crazy moms and how they drive and they don't watch anybody and they could kill anybody at any second? I go, you have more chance of being killed by a mom in a car than any active shooter. I said, let me make that clear to you.
Now I'm going to ask you to slow it down a little bit.
I'm sorry. I know I only have a little time.
Yeah.
So.
No. It's not. But you're saying all the right things, all the important things, all
it's
the things
bad.
Mothers need to hear, schools need to know. But just take it down a notch.
Okay. So they're not telling us anything. They're not telling us as teachers when there is going to be an active shooter drill. They're not telling parents when the drills are occurring. I found out only because my daughter verbalized to me that it happened. I didn't know that there was an active shooter drill that day.
Mm-hmm. And what are you supposed to do during an active shooter drill?
We're supposed to get the kids to stay in a corner because I have a room with no closet. I mean, we're not talking about elementary school, right? So it's high school.
Okay.
There's no closets in the high school, you know, rooms.
Right.
So we are stuck in a corner. Okay?
Turn off the
with
lights.
One door access.
Right.
And everybody has to stay quiet, all right?
Okay.
Sometimes they make us stay in the room for like 40 minutes.
Wow.
And we get no announcements, no text. I mean, the school could email us. We all have our phones on us. They could tell us what's going on.
Wow.
So now the trauma begins as a teacher because now I don't know what's going on. How am I supposed to keep my children, you know, calm? Mm-hmm. I now have to stay calm not knowing what the heck is going on.
Right.
And meanwhile, my life is in danger, too. So all of this is put on the teacher, and we're not trained for this kind of thing.
Exactly.
So
slow it down.
At the moment that it's happening, it's very traumatizing for teachers.
Nobody's talking about that either. And
nobody's talking about how
to engage the faculty in the procedures and what is a reasonable solution to the problem.
Exactly. Now, what I would
suggest
to every parent.
It's from the top down. But go ahead. This is what we want.
Yeah, it's from the top down. So every parent should know that every school is required to have an emergency evacuation plan. It must be written. So every parent can probably go on a website and find the emergency evacuation plan, and then it has everything there. It has fire drills, it has active shooter drills. Whatever drills the school performs, it must be written down as an emergency plan. So every parent has access to that plan. So every parent can ask in the beginning of the year, can I have your plan? And probably they're going to tell them it's online. It's, you know, just click this and you can find it.
Okay.
So that's really important, too. Like, so as teachers, we're required to go over the emergency plan in every school. That's usually a part of staff, you know, faculty
of
meetings
course.
And
yeah.
stuff like that.
Right.
So, but the problem is we're never asked what we think the resolve to these problems should be. I mean, now they're thinking I should have a gun. I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. So,
you're not in fear. Okay, so how do you say your name?
I just have one more thing to say.
Go ahead.
Art is the first thing they cut in school. And it's really a shame because I think art, even without the context of therapy, is therapeutic in itself. Because the student is creating something. Whenever you're creating something, that is therapeutic in itself. So just having more art and requiring art would be such a great thing for kids that may not have access to art therapy or parents that are familiar with art therapy. I mean, I teach students that are traumatized on a daily basis through domestic violence, through issues of urban issues. The school that I teach in is more safe inside the school than outside the school.
Right.
All the shootings are taking place outside the school.
Yeah.
So we have a reverse situation where kids feel more safe in the school than they feel outside the school. So these active shooter drills really make no sense.
Mm-hmm. Thomasina, we want to thank you for calling us. Call us in the future where you have a valuable voice for our show, and we thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 212-757-5555. People can get really animated about this. And, of course, teachers are on the front line.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Well, and that's great information. I mean, Kamasina brings up an excellent point of advocacy where as teachers and parents, we can rally together right now and A, inform each other. Teachers can be informing parents how bizarre these drills are actually presenting. And then as groups, we can go back to the administration, go to your principals, go to your superintendents and say, this is what this looks like. Can we look up alternatives? Because this seems ridiculous. And as teachers, we're feeling really anxious, encouraging our students to just be silent for 40 minutes on end.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, we can introduce specific things that they can be engaging in while they're being quiet. And you can say, we're rehearsing a safety drill and we're going to be doing these nonverbal coloring sheets. You don't have to pitch it like that, but okay. You give them an actual activity okay. that is peaceful. It's like, okay, everybody's going to get a circle. And you're encouraged to color inside that circle or outside of that circle during this 40-minute safety drill where we're not sure if we're going to be in silence for 5 minutes or we're going to be in silence for 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one small example of I'm thinking of right now in response to that call where that's something a teacher can actually do even if their administration isn't giving them permission to.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah. 212-757-5555. Teachers take a lot of things into their own hands. Bringing in a ladder is a new one for me. I never heard of something like that.
It makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It's logical.
Flight makes sense. If you can get it. So we're talking about a serious thing here. 212-757-5555. And we want your input. Do you have a child who's anxious, who's showing some signs of trauma? And what are you doing with them? Talk more about your successes with Newtown. Weren't you talking about the whole family creating an island that was safe and that there was this aha moment by one of the parents with volcanoes or something? Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah, Kevin is reflecting on last week we met to do the show and we ended up talking about the show because it was postponed. And I shared a really powerful art therapy example where the Emerald Sketch, the art therapy program I engage. First, we do outreach where we went into Sandy Hook and Newtown and we educate the community on how art therapy heals the symptoms of trauma. And after one of those initial educational groups, I started art therapy with a family who lost one of their children, one of three, and the two surviving children were coming to group art therapy with their parents, as well as some other family members, some cousins, and a neighbor. The family wanted to bring everyone in for this initial session.
Wow.
Yeah.
With no prompting. They decided on...
The core family that had the loss had come to an outreach session.
Okay.
And then they located, okay, this is an excellent resource for us. Art therapy is a wonderful match for our surviving children and us. And then they pulled in more of their own community.
Okay.
And then this is the session you were asking me about where the directive was to create a safe creature or a safe island. And they could work on the safe island together or they could do a safe creature themselves that they then add to the safe island.
Okay.
And
so you could work independently or as a group.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the group was compromised of, we're going to say 9 people for the purposes of the talk right now. Right. Half were children, half were adults. And the children age ranges were from 2 to 9. And the adults all started working on the island first, which makes a lot of sense. You know, the adults want to build the community for the children. And I noticed as a clinician that the adults looked like they were all building volcanoes. And you heard the directive. It was to create a safe island. So I'm thinking, oh, volcanoes. Okay. And I'm just observing. I'm letting the process unfold. And the children are all drawing. They're choosing to work with colored pencils and draw different animals that are their safe creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And as the process goes deeper and deeper, all of a sudden one of the mothers notices, hey, you know, we're supposed to be working on a safe island and we're all making volcanoes. And they started to dialogue about this, and all the moms started to say, hey, wait a minute, do we really want volcanoes on the island? And then one of the moms actually identified, like, how angry she is at the loss and that they're choosing volcanoes because of that, and we want to keep the volcanoes on the island, even though they don't necessarily make the island safe. That's where we are right now.
Mm. So it's a symbolic of the embroiled belly of the adult that creates a volcano. And they're not doing it consciously. I love this aspect of creative arts therapy where you're producing something in the moment to translate something that's going on inside of you and giving a physical representation of that. And so a volcano makes sense. Probably every adult in the room is feeling volcanic.
And the children.
And the children, of course, too. You know, so I love it. I love it as like an aha moment that, wait, we're all doing this. It wasn't just one adult.
And that mirroring process.
Did you mirror?
Well, no, as far as, I was throughout once we get shift and do the discussion part.
Right.
But that the way mirror neurons work, that even with trauma, like we're talking about the positive side when I'm helping people rebalance, but that mirroring happens across the board. So with trauma, that's one of the dangers where one person starts building a volcano and it's cathartic. They're sublimating, they're expressing themselves in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
But you think about without the therapeutic nest and if people are mirroring upset feelings and it just goes out and out and out and out and out.
Right.
We're going to take a real quick musical break. Right now it's about half past the hour. We'll be back shortly after this with more of your calls.
I've got 196 different kind of oil pans. The electric toaster. There is a thing in here that wasn't one time or another used on the Lincoln Highway.
Highway Dub here on 99.5 FM, WBAI, taking your calls at 212-757-5555. We have a few of you on hold. Just like to ask you to be patient and please keep holding. We're going to take Ann quickly. Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for taking my call. I hope there's not too much ambient sound around me. I started Crossing Point Arts about 7 years ago, and we teach workshops in the arts to survivors of human trafficking all over New York City in anti-trafficking agencies. And the reason I wanted to call and put my voice in this is that we are actually teaching artists working with trauma-informed guidelines. And this is also an important part of the discussion in addition to the creative arts therapy approach and works, you know, hand in glove with it. Mm-hmm. And just in a broader perspective, I devised the idea because the history of enslavement has also included the history of creative response to transcend one's circumstances. So
sure.
Art has been side by side with trauma and violence and healing for all time, basically.
Right. And when we were cavemen, we could be outside, doing our artwork to digest and integrate our traumas. But being indoors and being in our structured lives, we lose connection with creativity and creative materials. What do you mean? Could you talk a little bit about the trauma-informed guidelines?
So the trauma-informed guidelines when working with survivors of trafficking actually have to do a lot with what your on-air creative arts therapist was mentioning. Is there's a tremendous amount of mirroring. There is there's no questioning of the history, the story attached to the trauma, but if it comes out, it's a very particular kind of listening and supporting, and it's also, since we work in group settings, it's bringing the group into the support process because they have a shared experience of as trafficked people, and that goes across the board. They maybe have been labor trafficked, domestic servitude, sex trafficked, which is the majority of what goes on, and
So I love that you're informing us about there's no questioning about the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems so useful to me. Yeah. And you can chime in on this too, Nicole. You don't want to get information.
Right.
Right?
There's no interrogation.
Right? You don't want to push the narrative along, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Anne, if you could say a little bit more about that, and then Nicole will have a comment.
Yes, the stories unfold if they need to, because processing trauma is a very dynamic world within someone who's resolving this area of their life. They might be working on it for their entire lifetime. In most cases,
right.
They will be.
Yes.
But the importance is, in our work, is actually awakening the access so that they realize they have tools. These are therapeutic tools that help them manage their trauma in a long-term capacity.
Exactly. Well said. Very well said. To enable access. That's the goal.
Mm-hmm. And also introduce, I coined the term art at home because people weren't turning in this direction to realize, wow, when I draw, I can feel myself calming down. One case an example, a young woman who was born into a shelter and taken into foster care at 6 months because of her addicted mother couldn't care for her, and was trafficked out of foster care, which is very often what happens. And the amount of violence that she had endured was astonishing. But when she understood that making art was the key to helping herself ground, anchor, and calm down, as she would call it, she suddenly produced 25 pieces of art, and we had a one woman show for her in June. And she's, a 25-year-old person who's just come through the ranks with the anti-trafficking support services.
Right.
And it's astonishing what flows out of people once they realize that they have access to it and can feel safe about what's coming out of them.
Absolutely. That fluency you're talking about, that flow that people are able to access with something like art therapy or music therapy, is integral.
Mm-hmm.
We're really grateful for you coming on the air and sharing your experience with us.
Thank you very much, Anne.
Thank you. I just want to say crossingpointarts.org, and if there are teaching artists who are interested in connecting with us, please find us through the website and write to me, because I would love to hear what you're doing and see if we could collaborate.
Very good. Thank you for your input. And so I think she makes a really important point about not pushing the narrative and getting
Absolutely.
Access to, and that this is often a lifetime experience, that the person who suffers the trauma is often digesting it through a lifetime, and we're not pushing them through it. We're not trying to rush the process. We're trying to help them get access to the trauma, to the pain, and to enable a shift to happen.
Absolutely.
212-757-5555. We lost a call. We'd love to get you back. Go ahead.
I'm thinking about, we're talking hand in hand about art therapy and then also these anti-shooter drills that are this new phenomenon. And I just kind of want to bring us back to that a little bit more and focus on the positives and the beauty of when you are a secure child You know, like that's one thing we really want to talk a little bit more about, I think, is how to maintain that sense of security for your children and in the schools when the administration and legislation is saying, okay, now you have to do these drills. It's like, okay, how can we maintain a sense of control? Because the truth is, the safer and the more secure our pupils, our children, our students feel, the better they can handle any type of disaster. It doesn't matter how many times we practice a so-called active shooter drill. If the children feel afraid, they're going to have a lot harder time responding quickly. Whereas up until that day, if they feel strong and secure and connected to the teacher in their classroom, they are going to move with that teacher when the teacher says move.
So are you saying that the training should begin with at the teacher level, with the teachers, that they're the ones that are
most
influential in the mood of the child in the classroom in general anyway, the sense of safety of the child?
Yeah, I think that's one huge takeaway. Like one of our callers, we've heard from a few teachers, and it seems really clear, and with my own personal research, that teachers aren't getting the information they need. So that says to me, as parents, as therapists, we need to move together, get more information to the administrators, and also help the teachers feel safe and empower them to help the children.
Mm-hmm.
And to be educated as parents. It's your choice as a parent whether your child's in attendance on the day of an active shooter drill. And I think it's our responsibility as parents to get involved and ask questions. When are they happening? How are you handling them?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's lots of protocols out there, and every school could be doing it differently. The examples we heard today are children being asked to hide in corners. There are some schools that are handling it where they're trained to evaluate the situation. They're trained to barricade the door. They're trained to evacuate the building. But until you ask those questions, as a parent, you don't know. So get involved.
212-757-5555. So is the answer for parents to just, once the show's over, to call their school? Call your school.
Find out.
Why aren't they learning and understanding what's this school that's taking care of your child doing in terms of being proactive about active school shooting drills?
Well, not only that, you can also, as a parent, say to your child, what do you know about this topic? You know, you can safely say to a child, I think, at most ages in our culture, especially over the age of 8, especially if you are aware that your child is aware. You know, most parents should know if your own child has seen it in the news or been exposed, but get your child's feedback. See how they feel about it. They're going to know. They're going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you can always let them know if they have questions that you feel a little insecure about answering. I think one safe answer to say is, wow, that's an excellent question. I'm going to do more research as your mom or dad, and I'm going to get back to you, or as your teacher. And we can do that in the classroom, too. You can also set the tone. It's a new school year. Introduce your classroom with the idea that this is a safe place for them to bring questions about their safety to you. If they're feeling unsafe or they have a concern, if it's regarding their walk to and from school or what's going on in the school, identify yourself as an adult that they can come to. And that makes a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because that also reminds me about, we've been talking, Kevin and Ben and I were talking before the show about, you know, creating coalitions of parents and teachers and older students. Middle school, high school students are capable of getting involved to start groups that look at the social media of all the students and pay attention to what's going on. Are there students feeling isolated that could benefit from comfortable outgoing students reaching over and saying, hey, do you want to join this group with us? Do you want to come to this social outing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, when I look at what seemed to me to be sort of the commonalities as I see consistently in these scenarios, it seems like there are kids who are living very painful lives, and and usually there's some kind of bullying involved in that pain that they're experiencing. And it seems to me to be a really common factor in almost every one of these incidents. And so it almost seems like if we could address that and find a way to bring more compassion, more kindness, more love in our schools. I mean, I know it's not probably in this day and age almost a revolutionary and maybe even controversial idea. But yeah. It seems to me that it comes down to making sure everyone is heard and not to say that anyone is justified in doing that kind of thing. Carrying out that kind of violence because they feel like they're sort of shunned or bullied. But That being said, it just seems...
But it is predictive. It is predictive. If a kid has been a loner for 10 years and through the school system and, he's fairly isolated, that is a predictive factor. And, yes, you want the administration, you want the teachers on the ground to be aware, to know, what is the counselor, what's the file on this child? I have a concern about him. Teachers have an incredible burden. They have to know so many things. They need to know their material. They need to know how to present it. They need to be a psychologist. They need to know how to prevent one child from affecting another child, distracting everybody from, the lessons and all these things. And now we want them also to be aware of the damage that certain drills can do to certain particular children, which children are vulnerable during a particular time of year or in a particular class. It's an incredible burden, but knowledge is power. Awareness is power. And I think teachers can be equipped with this information and use it creatively themselves. So, I mean, it's, knowledge we need, teachers do actually have to take on additional information that they need to use as a resource with their children in their classroom. And it's an extra burden. But once they've done and they've gotten used to doing it, and looking at the child as a psychological entity, a psychological being, they can be that much more effective and compassionate and kind. So I think proactive is the critical thing. But bullying, for sure, is a target. Bullying behavior, more than anything else, is a predictive variable, right? Shouldn't schools be on the lookout and have all faculty with their ears open to children that are being bullied and to do something about it immediately?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a humanitarian question. We should always be looking out to protect the children, especially in our school systems, right? I mean, I think that's what the mission was when they approved these actor shooter drills. They're thinking in the light of, we want to protect our children, not knowing the translation is, oh my gosh, we might actually be distressing tens of thousands of more of them with these drills. But with what you're bringing up, it reminds me of a few other, I know it's difficult because they're, like you said, teachers are burdened with so many things that they're supposed to be achieving. Mm-hmm. But given the fact that this is a new layer, I think it could be useful to do something like a concern box where students are encouraged and invited to anonymously drop a concern into the box where they know the teacher might go through it every Monday or every Friday. The teacher's going to go through it. And then that also gives an opportunity for children to relate to each other without being scapegoated, without being the one who's saying, hey, I'm concerned. I can't think of a particular example right now, but, I'm concerned that I'm getting picked on my way into the school.
Right.
Then a teacher brings that up and says, hey, someone put this in the concern box. There might be five other people that raise their hand and say, I have that concern. Okay, now let's have a short conversation about it. That's something positive a teacher could do just for 5 minutes.
Sure.
Or a parent could do just for 5 minutes. And that could have an impact for an entire month for a particular child.
Mm-hmm. And the school can deliberately design it into the day as 5 minutes after lunch break or 5 minutes in the morning or whatever. So tell us about Emerald Sketch.
Emerald Sketch. So we are an art therapy trauma response advocacy team where we are located now in New York City. It was based in Sandy Hook initially for the first 18 months. The mission was to mobilize therapy while Newtown was gaining the resources to maintain the financial clinical sessions and take on having full-time art therapists in their community. So now we mobilize, and I was just in Santa Fe in Houston, Texas, training clinicians. We've gone to Charleston, South Carolina, training clinicians.
Training them to do what?
To provide clinical trauma therapy.
Which is
after
what?
Massacres occur.
And flesh out some of those things that you would be telling them what to do.
As far as the therapy goes?
Yeah. I mean, you're training people to do what?
So I'm training clinicians to, A, go in and educate a community on how art therapy works.
A lot of what we talk about today.
Where we go in and we'd start with a PTSD scale and an art therapy task where I might ask the group to draw a safe person in a type of weather. And then everyone in the group takes 20 minutes and they do a pencil drawing with colored pencils or regular pencil. And then we process it. They experience the group process where aha moments happen. someone might notice that they're in the middle of a thunderstorm and they didn't put their character in rain boots or with a raincoat. And they didn't notice that until they put it on the wall in front of everyone.
Yeah.
So then they go, aha, what is that saying?
Right.
About me, I'm not comfortable protecting myself right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it also says that this is important, that this activity, this exercise is an eye-opener.
Absolutely.
Right? So it,
more
than
coloring.
Teaching, yes, you're teaching, you're training people to see the value of this by doing it themselves and seeing what narrative comes from that.
Exactly.
What discoveries come from that? What else do you do you do in these trainings?
So following a training like that, then we educate the participants on how trauma heals the mind-body. What is actually going on in the brain when that shift happens? And what goes on in the brain when you're traumatized? Why does the verbal process, why does the left hemisphere shut down? Because the distress is so significant, the body has to retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And that is all explained in these educational workshops, where then typically almost all of the people that attend them sign up for clinical therapy, where they then begin having therapy weekly for free. We get it for free through the Emerald Sketch. And that's another huge benefit. And it's when people find us, that's who we go and help typically, because there's so many tragedies globally at the moment, between hurricanes and...
So you never know when you're going to be called in next.
Exactly. I mean, in New York City right now, I'm helping clinicians that have had a 25% increase with migrant children. And that's been my focus in New York just in the last few months, given the
crisis because
in our country.
These communities are traumatized with the loss of the parents or the loss of the children themselves. And what would you do with them? Would you do creative art therapy also with them?
Well, in the instance with the Emerald Sketch, I'm coming in as a clinical supervisor. So I'm training the trainers who are on the ground with their boots right now, working with the families, the migrant children that have been displaced.
Okay.
And in that case, they have trauma. So it's trauma therapy.
Of course.
They have all types of different forms of trauma. So we go through very similar protocols. That's why it's effective. Yeah. And I mean,
how about a connection to New York City? I mean, to the mayor's office or something. To what about that? Has Emerald Sketch done anything? What is New York City doing in terms of community outreach for traumatized communities?
There's no direct funding for psychological response in any large... I mean, there's nonprofit organizations that exist for that cause. That's like the Emerald Sketch. Mm-hmm. Like, that's where I've had a lot more success raising funds privately. Right now, if you go to emeraldsketch.com, we have campaigns going for both Santa Fe and the migrant child crisis on our website that people can contribute to. And I've just found it more effective. Like, there's always federal money for things like this, but you have to apply, and it takes 9 to 18 months to 2 years before the funding comes in.
Right. Any last thoughts?
I'm just very glad that Nicole could be with us again.
Yeah.
And it was a great show, very illuminating, very...
really?
Lot of,
I like that word, illuminating.
Yeah, I learned a lot today, so thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having
me. Yeah, and I learned that, you know, schools and parents need to communicate better, because parents really don't even know that these drills are going on, and there's no excuse for that at this stage of the game. We want to thank you for listening. You've been listening to Talk Back at the Positive Mind. We're sorry we missed that last call. We wanted to get you in, but I'm glad we could flesh out the rest of this, Nicole, for the audience. We will be back next week, next Wednesday, from 3 to 5. Hope you're enjoying these hours with us as much as we are with you.
And every Wednesday.
And every Wednesday.
3 to 5 p.m. here on 99.5 FM, WBAI. And find us on iTunes. Check out The Positive Mind. We're free on the iTunes store. It's a free podcast. You can subscribe, download. Anything you miss, you can get for free, downloaded to your computer. Thanks again. You have been listening to The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue. Our guest today, Nicole Wilcox. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Keep listening.
All right. Thanks. Take care.